I'm Gary Coles. The title of this lecture is Jesus Was a Pacifist. To create interest, I added the little phrase, and he ate organic food. That was just a hook. Obviously, it didn't work very well. There's only six people here. It was the little subtitle was inspired by Gordon Lightfoot's 1960s era song, Jesus Was a Capricorn. And I don't remember the whole thing. It's just a great song. You know, listen to it sometime. But it goes something, the first verse goes something like this, that Jesus was a Capricorn. He ate organic food. Long hair, beard, and sandals, and a funky set of friends. I think if he came down again, we'd nail him up again, or something like that. You know, just sort of that image kind of struck me. Yeah, Jesus was kind of a hippie, you know, in a way. He associated with the scum of the earth, basically, the poor people, the disadvantaged, and he was just for justice, and he was for peace, and he was obviously also a pacifist. I got that. That's right off the pages of the gospel. Nobody debates that. Walt Keller and I were talking, and he says, yeah, Jesus was a pacifist. We know that the apostles were also pacifists. The early church regarded itself as a pacifist community. The early Christians refused to join the military despite persecutions. They were conscientious objectors to war. There's not a single church father or mother in the early 300 years of Christianity that talked anything but that. They understood that killing was not within the mind of Christ. Pacifism is oftentimes misunderstood as being passive. P-A-S-S-I-V-E has nothing to do with pacifist. Pacifism means peacemaking. And there are all sorts of varieties of it. There's absolute pacifism where absolutely nothing is done to injure anybody else or resist. But there is active pacifism, which is the model of Christ and Gandhi and Martin Luther King, where evil and the principalities and the powers and the domination system are actively confronted, but not by the use of the sword. That's the difference. People can resist evil in all sorts of ways. The follower of Jesus, in their first 300 years, went up against the principalities and the powers, but they did not use the threat or the use of violence. It's clear from the gospel that's what Jesus meant when he said, love your enemies. Christian nonviolence is, the examples of Christian nonviolence are just so numerous in the gospel as to be virtually uncountable. And if you read the gospels again with that in mind, it just opens up the meaning of the gospels in an entirely new light. I would suggest, at this point I should probably mention some books. Walter Wink's Engaging the Powers is a wonderful book, and the middle five chapters are all about Christian nonviolence and a strong defense of that. The best book in the library right now is this little one called August 9. It just came yesterday. It's only $3.50. I would recommend it highly. It's a number of short essays, basically, that talk about Christian nonviolence, examples of Christian violence, etc. It's a huge subject, and this, giving a really full picture of this in 1 hour is woefully inadequate. It takes a weekend seminar, it probably should take a week-long seminar, and to fully absorb it, it takes a lifetime. And most of us who have been exposed to Christian education have not had very much, if any. There are people in the church that have had the best Catholic education, best Protestant education that can be had, and have never had a course on Christian nonviolence, even though it's the most ancient Christian spiritual tradition. That's true of our seminaries, even. There's a consortium of seminaries in Boston, 8 or 10 of the best theological seminaries in the world, best education you can get, and they offer thousands of courses every year. In the last 10 years, there has not been one course that that teaches the history, theology, or spirituality of Christian nonviolence, not one. And yet it's the most ancient Christian spiritual tradition. Something's wrong. I just went into the library now and looked in the concordances and the encyclopedias and stuff and looked up love of enemies. Couldn't find it. There's no exegesis of love your enemies, which was the most commonly used phrase in the early Christian church. In the first 200 years of Christianity, love your enemies was the most commonly quoted phrase of Jesus. The early church that knew Jesus best understood that Jesus rejected violence, and they themselves rejected as well. Not that occasional Christians didn't use it, but in the first 300 years, the church's teaching was violence is forbidden if you wish to follow Jesus. In 215, the apostolic tradition of Hippolytus is a list of, it's one of the earliest writings of the Christian church, kind of rules for conduct of the church. And in there is a segment that talks about the entry into just the process to be baptized. It took years sometimes just to go through the process to be baptized. That's called the catechumen. And the catechumenate, the candidate for baptism, if you're a pimp, it says in Article 14, if you're a pimp, you must give up pimping if you just want to enter the process to be baptized into the church. Now, if you're going to sell men and women for sexual purposes, that's kind of, you have to give that up. That's pretty minimal morality. Two sections later, it says, if you are a soldier, you must tell your superior officers that you will not kill, or you must leave in order to enter the catechumenate. If you aren't a soldier already and you want to enter, you may not join. Pimping and being a soldier were as much outside the mind of Christ in the early church as anything. So those were sort of equated. That, of course, is not how it is now, obviously. The nonviolence, the violent Saul, you know how violent Saul was? He was a persecutor of the church. He became the nonviolent Paul after his conversion. He refused to kill. He was willing to suffer, willing to even die, refused to kill. The early church understood that the temple on earth was the human person. Jews may need Jerusalem, Muslims may need Mecca, but Christ is risen, and the Christian does not need temple to worship. There was a non-temple religion because they knew the temple on earth was the human person. The spark of the divine was in the human person. To desecrate the temple by killing the human person was outside the mind of Christ. That was part of the reasoning. They didn't join the military not only because they couldn't kill, but because it was idolatry. In order to join the Roman army, you had to pledge allegiance to Caesar. You had to bow down before Caesar, and that was considered idolatrous. And that was another reason why they refused to join. The centerpiece of the conversion, you know, we know what we're talking about now is absolutely contrary to what Christians feel about just wars and military service and military chaplaincy and everything. How did that change from justifying war in modern Christianity and from what Jesus said and what's all over the pages of the gospel? The centerpiece of that whole conversion is the Emperor Constantine. Constantine was fighting for total supremacy in the Roman Empire. He had to kill his father and kill some members of his family to attain that. And he eventually did. On the evening before a famous battle, the Battle of Melvian Bridge, where the winner was going to take all, he saw a vision, claimed he saw a vision at night that, you know, it was a vision of the cross, and it said, in this sign you will conquer. And so that morning he roused everybody up and they painted crosses on the horses and the shields and all the implements of war, and he won the battle, October 28th and 29th, 311. And so he looked around and realized, I won this battle, and he probably got the idea. Well, that's a sign of Christianity. And he started thinking, well, we've got all these Christians here, 300 years of Roman persecution, brutal persecution, killings, and, you know, throwing them to the lions. You know some of the history of that. It's brutal persecutions. 300 years of persecution of Christians only resulted in the religion growing. 300 years of persecution met with 300 years of nonviolent response, and they grew to the largest religion in the empire. So he looked around, he was a pretty shrewd guy, he says, why are we trying to kill it? We can't kill off the religion, obviously. Let's bring them in. And so he issued the Edict of Milan in 313 that said, we'll tolerate Christianity. And then he started, over a process of years, taking pagan temples away from the pagan religions and giving them to the Christians. And property and prestige and prerogative. And so Christianity became a state church. That's what would happen. When it became a state church, and all the teachings then were saying, well, if the church is going to survive, we have to have the state survive. That was that mindset, you know. So they then started defending the state militarily against the barbarians, and eventually Christians started joining the military and joining the brutal Constantinian empire, and they just kind of got sucked in. So, and in the year 406, the emperor was Theodosius II. He decreed that in order to be in the Roman army, you had to be a Christian. In 311, Christians were not allowed to be in the army. So in a matter of 105 years, whereas it was illegal to be a Christian and be in the army, but in 105 years later, you had to be a Christian to be in the army, and the rest is history. The Bishop of Milan was Ambrose. He was basically a dictator of a wealthy family in Milan, Italy. And there were some controversies going on. He was not a Christian, but he was a leader, though, in that very wealthy community. And so some Christians said, well, why don't we have you get into the Christian church? And I mentioned earlier, in order to go through the catechumenate, well, it took years in the early Christian church. Bishop Ambrose went from baptism to confirmation to the diaconate through various processes, and he was made bishop. From that whole process took 8 days. It took 8 days to get the bishop, and after he became a bishop, he said, I don't know much about Christianity. And it wasn't too long afterwards he wrote the first Just War Theory. The Just War Theory we use, it was written by St. Augustine, which was Ambrose's student. And specifically says, citizens shall be protected from the violence and the murder in wartime. That's one of the inviolable precepts, which means that there has not been a war or a revolution that has fulfilled the precepts of the Just War Theory.
There's
a whole bunch of precepts, but one of them is that civilians are protected from injury.
It would make sense. In old times, you had two armies out someplace 20 miles away, and they'd fight it out, and then some runner would come back and say, you know, Team A won, and then politically things would change based on Team A winning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was a different situation back then. But there's nothing biblical about the Just War Theory either. That's a purely, it was a secular person who just made bishop in 8 days, you know. He didn't know anything about Christianity. He wrote the first theory. And Augustine believed that the state had to help the church, and the church had to help the state. So did Ambrose. So basically church-state were one. And if the state was threatened, the church said, we may not survive. So the violence was then used to ensure the survival of the church. So they were willing to compromise what they knew Jesus said in the first 300 years with what the practicalities were, or so they thought. There's a book here called The Early Fathers on War and Military Service. And there's not one in the first 300 years that doesn't say, love your enemies, it's not okay to kill. Tertullian said, when Jesus disarmed Peter in the garden, he disarmed all Christians. Origen said, the Christians were criticized for not helping and defend the empire against the barbarians. And Origen said to the emperor, we do more to prevent war by our prayer and mercy to the barbarians than you do with your military army. So there was no question Christian pacifism was the norm of Christianity, of the religion in the first 300 years.
Well, Luke though has these soldiers coming up to John the Baptist to be baptized, and he doesn't say to the soldiers, stop being soldiers. But he says, don't do this and don't do that, which is an intriguing thing, because by then already there was some compromise being effected.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, there's a whole lot in that conversation that wasn't written down. We have no idea what it was. So, and of course, that was one of the centurions who was just in charge of the other people. And there may have been peace at that time, I mean, a perceived peace. The Roman army was more of a police force, just kind of keeping the peace. They had already done the brutal colonization, and at that time, the Jews were pretty passive and just... they were kind of planning the revolution, but doing so very cautiously, because every time they rose up, they were brutally put down. Question?
Sorry, this is sort of what I was leading to last night. But sometimes I think, like, was Jesus really a pacifist? Like, let's say, if he saw a bad guy who he knew was going to kill 6 million people, wouldn't he kill them? I think I'd like to think I'm a pacifist, but then again, if I saw a robber who had a gun and I knew he was going to kill 100 people and I had a gun, I'd feel like God would want me to kill him. I mean, even though I feel... Right? I think about it. I don't know the answer to that, but I'm just wondering, I mean...
Yeah. There's all sorts of... When the truth of Christian nonviolence is presented, there's usually about half a dozen classical objections, you know? And one of them is, what about Hitler? And what if someone's going to kill and rape you, or my wife, or something like that? And one is, well, Jesus said, I come not to bring peace, but a sword. Well, sword is a metaphor for trouble. You know, if you're going to follow Jesus, you're in for trouble. Sword was a metaphor for trouble. Or the cleansing of the temple. Well, wasn't Jesus violent there? The answer to that is that's the cleansing of the temple is in all four Gospels. In the first three Gospels, there's nothing even about a whip of cords. That's only in John's Gospel. And so there's nothing about violence to humans. And even in John's Gospel, it is only used against the animals who are to be sacrificed. And a whip of cords is the normal way to move animals along. So you could say, well, Jesus was saving the lives of the sacrificial animals. And there's no evidence that Jesus used violence against any human. That's a false objection.
But the issue of if you do get into a scrape, I think the kind of a situation where there's a lot of compromise already. That is, somehow you've got a gun, which is odd. Somehow you know how to shoot their gun, which might also be odd. Somehow there's a guy with a gun who's somehow you know is going to kill 100 people. It would seem to me that it's on you. I mean, you have to live with yourself. Do you assume that this guy is going to kill these 100 people and blow them away? Or do you assume that this guy is just waving his gun around because he's nuts?
Right.
And he's not. So after he shoots the first person, do you blow him away? Or do you wait till he gets to. Because maybe he sees the first person die and realizes he's stupid. You know, it seems to me that raising the issue is, on your part, a suggestion that things are simple.
Right.
And my hunch is that if you had that gun, it's on you to really be engaged in a life and death issue. Because if you run toward this guy and jump on him, well, the other 100 people can take him down. So why don't you just sacrifice your life? That's an interesting...
The proper response to that is that crisis situations have 1,000 variables and they change every second. So you can't say, well, what if someone's is attacking my wife and gonna, well, is he gonna rape or will he respond, you know, what's happens next? Will he respond to a persuasion or, you know, will he respond to an act, a good deed? You know,
also,
there
if,
are tremendous
if you have a
numbers
gun in
of
a situation,
right.
Is that gonna cause things to get
worse,
that's right.
Worse or better? You can't know beforehand.
What I'm thinking right. About mainly, I guess, is like Christians in Germany, like if one of them had just killed Hitler, I mean, and knowing that they may be killed because of that or something, in a way that would seem very godly.
Yeah, but it would have been just as godly for you to kill Nixon.
I don't think so.
No, but you can't know.
A lot of similarities.
Oh, I see.
They didn't know about Hitler. They didn't know what Hitler was doing. Hitler was this great charismatic leader who got the trains to go on time. They didn't know about these death camps. And he was saying, you know, Poland belongs to us. And you know, it's sort of like saying, well, you know, Canada belongs to us. I mean, if it weren't for America, you know, where would Canada be? Canada belongs to us, and they owe us taxes. And they're not paying. You know, you get your mind into this thing, and Hitler is not evil. It's so easy for us to say, well, you know, why didn't somebody take Hitler out? But he was a great leader.
Didn't like Dietrich Bonhoeffer try, or just a couple?
But he knew that it was going to be a sin. Uh-huh. See, when you reject Christian nonviolence and you accede to kill whoever our state, non-Christian state, says to kill, you know, we demonize Iraq, the Iraqis, you know. So we go and kill, and now it's about 350,000 Iraqis have died because of that war, most of them children, innocent children. And That's where the evil comes in. Jesus was all about going up against evil and not allowing ourselves to be evil. If we do evil and think it's good, then we are evil ourselves. If we do evil and we think it's a sin, that doesn't make us evil, then we can repent of it. Our mindset, our military mindset, is that if the state says it's okay to kill, then that's legal murder. Basically, that's legal murder. Question.
One thing that I try to keep in mind as a peace activist is that it's not important to be successful, it's important to be faithful.
Very good. That's a great quote from Mother Teresa, and we should all apply it. God's job is success, our job is fidelity. And it's very true. Like I say, this issue should be a 15-hour weekend forum, and I hope that everybody's going to be doing the research and the reading themselves, especially the August 9 book. So what happened, of course, when Christianity adopted Constantine's philosophy and became a state church, you know, that there was a Council of Nicaea, which Constantine actually called 325. You know, he was the one presiding over this church group. And out of that came the Nicene Creed. And it's interesting to know, next time you say the Nicene Creed, in fact, the Apostles' Creed, look in there. It says Jesus was born of the Virgin Mary, died, and descended to hell. There's 1, 2, or 3 years in there of all of his mercy and his justice and his healing and his feeding the hungry missing. It's curious. Nothing about nonviolence in there whatsoever, which was what Jesus was all about. There was a Synod of Our Lady somewhere where it said, priests can only use clubs in war, they can't use spears. You know, the church, you know, after Constantine decided, well, priests can be in war, but they can't use spears, just to use clubs, you know. You see the evil process that kind of took off after 300. And here we are, you know. Last night, I think the majority of the people here still, after that process of discernment, still think it was justified to kill Japanese women and children, mostly civilians, including a bunch of GIs who were in prisoner of war camps and in the Hiroshima jail, both in Nagasaki, you know, and Hiroshima. Okay to kill them with a mass destructive weapon. You know, they don't get the connection, and I can't blame them because, you know, I'm a cradle Lutheran, and I was fed that all my life. And it isn't taught in the seminaries, so we're not learning from the pulpits, and we're not teaching it to our children from the pews, we're not teaching it in Sunday school, basically. I mean, there are exceptions, I grant you. But as a church, we go according to the Augsburg Confession, which was read last night. Let's see, I have it here. I'll read it again, at least the common part. Let's see. Okay. The adversaries receive without any exception, in which we have confessed that it is lawful for the Christian to bear civil office, sit in judgment, determine matters by the imperial laws and other laws in present force, appoint just punishments, so capital punishment if necessary, engage in just wars, of which there are none, act as a soldier, make legal contracts, hold property, etc., etc. And then in the explanation, you know, they just skip over. They don't say anything about Jesus' teachings of love of enemies or non-retaliation or rejecting eye for an eye, retaliation, revenge. It doesn't say anything about that. They just sort of repeat the, you know, it's okay to be a soldier. Being a soldier, I know what happens when people become soldiers, just the training process. I'm not talking so much about Air Force and Navy because they, you know, 35,000 feet, you don't see your victims. You don't hear the screams. You don't see the gruesome death and the horrible carnage that happens to the people. The bombing is always of indiscriminate targets. I mean, they try to discriminate the targets, but there are humans that are innocent civilians down there. So if you're in the Air Force, you know, you don't really see the death and the destruction and the pain. But if you're a Navy person, you're lobbing shells 20 miles away or whatever, you don't see the death and the destruction and the pain and the suffering. And you were not aware of what goes on for decades afterwards to the victims who are tormented psychologically by their, if they survive, by their pain and suffering. But if you're a Marine or an infantry, in the infantry, you learn to be a cruel killer. That's what basic training is all about. You become a professional killer. You do the idolatrous thing of pledging allegiance to the Corps, and you obey your commanding officer. Whatever his commands are, you obey. So when Lieutenant Kelly at Eli says, these are 500 people, mostly women and children and old men, they were massacred Nazi style. I mean, I'm sure there are excuses for that. But all of those pieces of people were decent human beings before they went in, but they did as they were told. And there were dozens, maybe hundreds of My Lai massacres, I'm told by my veteran friends that were over there. All through Vietnam, only one came to the fore because somebody was brave enough to say, some evil deed was done here, and raise it to our consciousness. We have to silence the victims. History silences victims. The victors write the history book, so we learn about the glory of war. Basically, history is written by military victors. You know, all the great events in military in our history books are military events. They're not written by the victims. We do not hear the voices. We cannot tolerate killing when we hear the voices of the victims, the cries. In the 600 years of the Christian church from 1248 to 1620 or something like that, actually it was 1600 years, there was a process called the auto de fe, act of faith it was called. It was where the church ordained burning at the stake and torture of heretics and Jews. You know, this was ordained by the church. And they have big celebrations, you know, big weekend events, and we're going to, you know, burn a bunch of people at the stake, and people would come, you know. People love hangings somehow. And then you could get a plenary indulgence if you came. And it was advertised, and people would come, a big celebration, but they couldn't hear the screams, so they stuffed rags in their mouths so they couldn't hear the screams. Or they would cut their tongues out so they couldn't have. Sometimes they would pierce hot irons through their cheeks, and really that helped them not, you know, there were for other reasons, it was torture, but then they couldn't articulate words. You can't hear the screams of the victims, or you can't. If you do, you can't kill. So that's one of the processes. And it went on for 600 years, you know, is that the way of Christ? Is the bombing of Nagasaki, innocent children, and what happened at Nagasaki, as many of you have heard the story, the Urikami Cathedral in Nagasaki was ground zero for the bomb. That was the landmark that the bombardier saw at Nagasaki to release the bomb. And what Imperial Japan could not do over a 200-year period to abolish Nagasaki Christianity, American Christians did in 9 seconds. It was evaporated, incinerated in 9 seconds. You know, is this the way of Christ? We have to ask. You know, I don't sit in judgment of military people. You know, I was one of the lucky ones. I was a physician willing to practice in a medically needy area, and I got a deferment from my draft board. You know, I didn't have to face all those issues. People who get sucked into that are victimized by propaganda. You know, this is a just war. We're going to hit, you know, whatever, going to kill Saddam Hussein, who's Hitler, which that was...
So economically...
Yeah, that's right. That's another. You know, you need a job. There's high unemployment rate, and all. You know, the military is a good, is a secure job, and you can just be in there for. But I'm not sitting in a judgment because we don't know how we would act in that situation. But it's part of the evil process is the a huge, I should say, huge bureaucracy structures, bureaucratic structures that allow terrible evil to develop, but nobody claims responsibility because it's a massive bureaucracy. You know, the people, if you saw the Day After Trinity film about Oppenheimer and the Trinity Project and the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs and the carnage that's happened ever since, the trillions of dollars that have gone into building weapons of mass destruction, which are designed for civilians and large urban targets, basically, you'll realize that none of those scientists feel much guilt. I mean, they were just part of the process. They were doing their job. They were taking orders from somebody, and they didn't pull the trigger. And even the Air Force pilot who dropped the bomb said, "Oh, I was just the end of the process. And I was just doing, you know, what I was told to do." The people who had Auschwitz run smoothly, the tens of thousands of people at Auschwitz, Poland, knew what was going on in there, and none of them felt guilty. It was good jobs. They were decent Christians, you know. It's a massive bureaucracy that allows tremendous evil to happen, and nobody's responsible. At the Nuremberg trials of the Nazi criminals, everybody says, it wasn't my responsibility, and it was right. And so they had to invent a new crime. First time they said crimes against humanity. They had to invent a new crime because nobody was guilty of it. You know, nobody was responsible, and the lawyers realized it. So they had to invent a new crime. Do you have a question?
I had a comment on, you said that you did not sit in judgment of people who performed in the military, mm-hmm. and nor do I. Mm-hmm. We're all products of our upbringing, mm-hmm. and our situation. But we do need to be judgmental of our government, and we need to become part of it and tear that apart.
Yeah. And as probably more important for those of us who profess Christianity is to sit it. I mean, to challenge our church and its silence on these subjects. You know, silence is consent, and when the church does not speak of the great social issues of the day and says nothing about killing, and the military chaplains say nothing about what Jesus said about killing, they give the Eucharist, and I'm not saying we shouldn't have military chaplains, but they kowtow to their superior officers who say, this is war, your job is to just kind of not raise any issues, don't rock the boat, just do the Eucharist. And then they counsel them when they're troubled, and they tell them to write home to mother and tell them not to, you know, drink and smoke and stuff like that. But they never mention what Jesus said about violence and war, and that's a serious moral, theological problem. And I never heard a word from my pulpit. I'm a physician, so I don't preach, but never heard a word from my pulpit about love your enemies. That only comes around once every 3 years or so in the lectionary. So, and then you can preach on Paul's epistle instead. So it never gets mentioned. It's not in the Book of Concord. Love of enemies isn't in there. I checked a couple other encyclopedias. Don't talk about love of enemies. You know.
A place that you can go is to traditional peace churches. I mean,
that's where you have to go.
And that's what a lot of folks have done.
What are they?
The Mennonite Church and the Quakers and others. And these folks really have a very well-developed sense of ethic and how they are separate from the culture as a church. And the churches live more deeply into the problems of this particular contradiction. And they do preach the pacifist line, that Jesus was a pacifist, very clearly. In fact, John Howard Yoder was mentioned last night, and he has a wonderful book. What's his first book?
The Politics of Jesus?
Politics of Jesus. If you're really interested in this, you should just read it. It's very clear and very straightforward.
He's done a lot of writing, but one of his great books is What Would You Do If? And it gives dozens of examples of those crisis situations where people have acted nonviolently and resolved it. Doesn't work all the time, but neither does violence. Violence never works because when the peace treaty is signed, the victims are suffering, the suffering is just beginning, and the retaliators are planning their revenge. That's what happens in Yugoslavia. You know, it took 40 years before the Croatians.
But you have to also acknowledge that if you're a Quaker, it doesn't solve it for you. I mean, you can join the American Friends Service Committee, you can go overseas and work with those folks. It's a different kind of engagement, but you still have the dilemma that all of America, I mean, your parents, beginning with your parents, think you're crazy.
Yeah.
So you're still in the dilemma of following Jesus has to have its own reward, mm-hmm. and you have to trust that somehow God is working through Jesus and through you to bring good. And you can't basically lose hope. And I think that's your witness, is that, you know, Gary Cole stands before us here as someone who continues to be a Lutheran and continues to press the church, even when, the church is not coming around very quickly.
And here's where loving your enemies makes sense. Here's where Christian nonviolence makes sense for me. And this is basic Christian ethics. This is, I know everybody hates this Christian ethics, and there's huge books on it. Here's a 5-minute explanation. It's all you need to know, probably. All rational ethical systems have survival as their main operating value. Personal ethics, it's your personal survival. You know, business ethics, it's the survival of your business. You know, national ethics, it's the survival of your nation. All these are what we call rational ethical systems. Rational meaning, reasoning or thinking. So survival is their, all of them have survival as their number one principle. And then they've got, you shouldn't kill and you shouldn't rape and you shouldn't steal and you shouldn't lie and you commit arson and shouldn't drop bombs on Nagasaki, all that sort of stuff. Those are ethical things that are good. But when your survival is threatened, everything goes out the window. You know, if you don't survive, there goes the good, the true, and the beautiful, and what's left. So survival is the number one operating principle, and anything goes. So therefore, Hitler was afraid those were, he wanted the Reich to survive for 1,000 years. Anything goes. Just get rid of the Jews, get rid of the homosexuals, get rid of the liberals, get rid of the unions, get rid of the communists, get rid of the useless eaters and the mental
institutions. It started way before that. It started with the World War I and the reparations that the rest of Europe and the United States laid on Germany, actually sucked the lifeblood out of Germany, made Germans look like they were totally to blame for a war that all Europe was to blame for, and they made them live in poverty. I mean, you talk to Germans who are 70 or 80 years old, you guys might know this, you talk to those folks, and they just tell you how terrible it was. All of the rest of Europe was blaming the Germans. The Germans were living in poverty, and they had the land taken away from it, and their faces rubbed in it every night. Hitler shows up and says, "We don't have to take these."
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And that's why World War II happened. It's because we failed to recognize that their survival was at stake.
Mm-hmm.
Hitler was giving them a way to live with justice.
And it worked. They thrived. And it was a military economy, just massive military industrial complex. The Krupp Empire was making weapons. In fact, they made weapons for England that was used against Germany.
But just like Boeing today. Just like Boeing today.
Boeing or Martin Marietta.
Martin Marietta.
You made that. Anyway, let's get back to the ethical thing. So survival is the main operating value. If anything else is threatened, if the survival is threatened, then anything goes. What's the number one value in Christian ethics? Christ-like love. And a bunch of others. I mean, you shouldn't kill, all those others shouldn't commit adultery and that sort of thing. But the primary operating value is Christ-like love. What's the number one operating value on a Christian ethical system is not even on the list of values. It's a non-value. Survival is a non-value in Christ-like and in a Christian ethics because Jesus said, "I am the resurrection, I am the life. He who believes in me shall live forever." Our survival is guaranteed. They're talking about earthly survival, we're talking about eternal survival. And so the Christian who professes Jesus as Lord and who we are to imitate and love as Christ loved, that gives us the courage then to say, it doesn't matter, I can go up against the principalities and the powers and the domination system. I can do it non-violently, don't have to risk killing anybody, but it takes some courage. The most courageous people I know are members of Amnesty International and Greenpeace and the people who are out there going up against violent people unarmed. Can you think of anything that takes more courage? It doesn't take much courage to be in a B-29, 35,000 feet over North Vietnam, yes.
Well, just, sorry, I don't mean to be antagonistic. Sure. I'm interested in this. But in a way, it seems like it's not courageous just to have a rule. And I agree that Christian ethics is, the main thing is to be Christ-like. And I thought Christ basically said, love each other, there are no rules. And I feel, in a way, like pacifism is, I mean, in a way I'd like to be, and I'm sort of thinking about it, or I've thought about it, but to me, I guess, in the end, I just thought, I can't have a rule, because that isn't Christian. I mean, no, it's really not Christian.
It's an ethic, it's a way of life, though. It's not a rule, it's a way of life. Put it on the mind of Christ, you know? Against,
or I always thought, like, you know, being a Christian, my main thing is to love. And do everything in love, and you start with love, and when you start substituting rules for love, then it's not really.
That's right.
I mean, and to so, me, the so most courageous rules. Thing is the most courageous thing in the world to me is to have no rules, and to. Mm-hmm. So it's almost scarier not to be a pacifist because it's easy to say, this is a rule. You know, I'm not going to kill anyone, yeah. No matter what. Then
but
I don't have to.
It's not a rule. It's a way of life. Uh-huh. Peace is the way of life. It's not a goal. It's the process. It's the road to the goal. You know. So it isn't. It's an ethical system is a moral, but not a right. I mean, but not a rule. Jesus did cast out all the the
right.
Leviticus
so
codes, the purity codes.
Yeah.
He brought a politics of compassion and love. That's where his power came from. The power
right.
of love, not the power of violence. You know. And then the other interesting thing is what is number one on the list isn't even attainable.
Right.
Survival isn't even attainable. You know. Everyone's got to die, you know, so it's a false system for the non-Christian, for the Christian.
Well, you could have the goal, survival for 60 years.
Sure, yeah, but you can quibble about that. The other thing that's important to know, and I'll introduce it this way, what if Jesus came down right now in our midst, you know, and he said, okay, I'm going to give you a chance to ask one question. And so we kind of huddle, and when we reject what's next week's lottery number, we sort of decide, what does it take to attain eternal life? You know, that would be, I think, what we would maybe decide. That's an eternal question. And Jesus would look at us and shake his head, I told you that 2,000 years ago.
No, he'd say, what do you think?
No, he said, I told you that.
Love violence and yeah. Love your neighbor
well,
as yourself.
Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, right. And love your neighbor as yourself. And then he would go, wait, that wasn't the answer we wanted. We wasted our question. Jesus, come back down.
What's
Let me ask you one more question. and so he said, okay, one more question. And then we'd huddle and he'd say, you know, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. What the question should be, what do you mean by love? What do you mean by love? And he'd shake his head and say, I told you that 2,000 years ago. On Maundy, Thursday, the night before the crucifixion, we broke bread together, and I said, I give you a new commandment. Love one another as I have loved you. Jesus is the definition of what Christian love is, obviously. What is Christian love is then the question. Now, and Tony takes off and told him, do we have to ask him what Christian love is? No, we can figure that one out. Christian love is agape. There are 333 times that love is used in the New Testament. But it was written in Hebrew, and Hebrew has three words for love. Americans, English only has one word for love. There's tremendous confusion about what is meant by love because when it was written in Hebrew, Greek. Koine Greek, which is an obsolete language now. But there was eros, is the common Greek word for love. That was what was the street language that was in all the books. It was eros. That's erotic love, not just romantic or sordid love. It was also a love of a hamburger, or love of God, or, you know, not love of God, except for the Greeks. But anyway, it was just that common everyday word for love was eros. And then the second one was philios. That was brotherly or sisterly love. Philadelphia, city of brotherly love. And then there's agape. The definition of agape at its, you know, you can condense that down to two portions. One is it is the willingness to serve or love without the desire for reciprocation, meaning I am willing to love you even if you don't love me in return. Eros demands love in return. And then the second part of agape is the willingness to suffer without the desire for retaliation. I'm willing to love you even if you are my enemy, and I'm risking, you know, a negative response. I'm still willing to love. That's love of enemies, is agape. Love in the New Testament is there 333 times. 320 of those times, the word is agape. 18 times, it's philios. Eros is never employed in the New Testament. The New Testament writings, our common day word for love, is never used in the New Testament, in the original Greek. That has tremendous implications. We, you know, so 1 Corinthians 13, that's agape. It's not, you know, love of my wife, you know. It's unconditional love, unconditional nonviolent love. It's unconditional nonviolent love of friend and enemy, which is what Jesus is all about, and which is the power of God. Violence can do the predictable. You know, we can figure out how many people are going to die in Nagasaki with an atom bomb, and they did, you know, and how much destruction there's going to be. Violence can do the predictable and the possible. Nonviolent love, agape love, can do the impossible. It is the power to empty tombs. Jesus wasn't a soldier, you know. If he had been, people say, well, maybe he was violent because he said, you know, I come not to bring peace but a sword. He didn't act that way, you know. He lived nonviolent love of friend and enemies. Look at his experience in the garden. There was a scuffle, you know. He knew what was going to happen. He knew he was going to suffer. And Peter cut off the ear of the armed servant of the high priest. You know, did Jesus say, get the other ear, Peter? No. He said, put up the sword. He who lives by the sword dies by the sword. And he reached over and healed the ear of the one who was going to take him to his death. He knew he had the power of love. He had the power to heal. He could have run, you know. Little chaos there. He could have gotten out of there, you know? Who among us would not have gotten out of there? But he knew he had that power, and he knew the enemy was to be loved as he loved, as God wants us to love. And he healed the person who was going to take him to his death. After that, he had no control. He allowed that to happen. Then on the cross, you know, he loved his enemies by saying, God, forgive them, for they know not what they do. The thief on the side, you know, I said, you'll be with me in paradise today. That was an enemy, you know, possible enemy. He was a crook. He deserved to die on the cross. Jesus taught an ethic of nonviolent love, of friend and enemies. There's no question about it. If you did the exegesis on this, I should mention this. Or if you're a biblical scholar, and there's a bunch of different methods to kind of figure out, you know, what the meanings of the New Testament and the Gospels are. There's various methods. If you are consistent with your method, and you think you can reject Jesus rejecting violence, then you also have to reject the Trinity, the virgin birth, the incarnation. There's nothing left. If you reject nonviolence, you also reject all of those dogmas in Christianity. Father John L. McKenzie, one of the most brilliant Catholic scholars there ever was, and the president of the, you know, distinguished biblical scholar, worldwide biblical scholar committee, said, if we cannot know from the New Testament that Jesus absolutely rejected violence, we can know nothing of his person or message. It is the clearest of teachings. Now, of course, you know, we as Christians are brought up in to be Constantinian Christians, that Christian that allows violence and allows just domination, and you know, we want to be powerful, but we want to be in bed with the state because they can tax us if we start going up against the brutality and the evils of the state. They have the power to tax our church buildings and our property, and right now that's tax deductible or tax exempt. So that's a little, you know, a little pressure there, and then we maybe better just kind of hold our tongue, compromise a little bit, and we do, but who among us doesn't, you know? I have blood up to my elbows by paying taxes. 50% of my federal income taxes goes to the military with the weapons and everything, you know, that goes with that. And 50% of the scientists in this nation that was higher in the 80s work just to develop weapons, you know. $22 billion every year we spend on just maintaining our nuclear weapons arsenal. $22 billion we just spent on maintaining nuclear weapons. Not even building new ones anymore. We're just maintaining them. $22 billion. And we claim unaffordability for programs of social uplift. And we're cutting, you know, 100,000 here and a million here. And we're going to cut public radio, which only $98 billion is all what they get. That's less than one F-16 or F-11, 111. You know, most of these high-powered jets are $100 million apiece, $150 million apiece. The B-2 bomber, we're spending $2.2 billion on every B-2 bomber, which is designed to deliver nuclear weapons to Moscow and to be invisible to radar. It never was invisible to radar, and we're not going to bomb Moscow, and we're building 20 of them at $2.2 billion apiece, and the government is going to want some more because it's good for business. Jesus tells us we can't serve God and money both. The bottom line in our military system, church-endorsed militarism, is money, it's jobs, security. If something threatens our security, everything goes out the window. We in the church, and that's where our discernment should be, we are citizens as well. You know, we need to look, okay, where are the oppressors, and vote them out of office. You know, yes, we have that duty, you know. We are called to be in the world. But we also have to do the moral discernment, and that has to be done as Christians. Are we to be imitators of Christ? Is the kingdom to come the kingdom of the Lamb or the kingdom of the Lion? The image of the Lamb is all over the New Testament. Jesus was nonviolent. He was a pacifist. We're called to follow him as disciples. You know, after last night, I kind of wondered, are we admirers of Jesus? Our followers? You know, are we followers of Luther and admirers of Jesus? Those are legitimate questions we need to keep asking ourselves. Jeff?
I think, though, from a pastoral point of view and from a spiritual point of view, you could make the argument that the texts of the New Testament are attempting to include people who would not feel themselves to be heroes and who would not feel themselves to actually... I think the New Testament tends to draw in people who feel like they failed. So I think you have to be careful about the imitation language, because a lot of folks just feel they love Jesus. They feel this sense of a profound love in the New Testament text, but they feel unworthy of it. And you know, I attempt to understand the world from the point of view of non-military. Perspective. Yet, I must say that your enthusiasm is almost intimidating to me. One must be careful as an evangelist, lest one lifts up this imitatio Christi so radically that the rest of us feel, geez, you know, glad Gary's doing it. Boy, you know.
I have all the sympathy in the world for pastors. I don't have as much to lose. I mean, I'm not going to get taken off the clergy roster.
Theologically. No, that's not the issue at all. I mean, I'll say
for some
want
people,
to,
it is.
Politically, but the issue is can I tell the truth about my own failures in relationship, my own failures with people that I'm supposed to love, people who loved me and they deserve love back, and I don't love them back. Now here comes an enemy, and I'm feeling hungry or tired today, or I've already been in meetings all morning. You know, that sense of being beleaguered. I think if there's any way that the powers that be win us, overcome us, overwhelm us, it's simply by inviting us to a life of overextension. We get so busy in the stuff that we do that we know, we can't read another article about Bosnia because it's hard to figure out what's going on there. I've got 3 minutes before the bell rings, so, and here's this, you know, 4 column inches of Bosnia stuff, and they're using words names that I don't know. I'm a sinner. You know, I walk away from that feeling really sinful, because I'm not imitating Jesus.
Yeah. And who is?
So what can we say
we're
going to
fail, but what we receive in the pews is, why bother to try? When we say, well, we're all fallen humans, as if we were celebrating, well, we're all fallen humans, can't do anything about it. The people in the pew sort of get the feeling that, well, why bother to try? And
well, that's
a deadly deception.
We have to incarnate
that's
that right here,
yeah.
So that the energy and the conviction that you have becomes something that gives each of us some, that the energy kind of fills in, filters in. You told me, buy this book over at the bookstore, it's on my list, buy this book over at the bookstore. That's a step for me. Yeah. I believe that the energy that you have somehow came out of this Guy McCarthy, who wrote this book on, August 9th, you know? So I'm going to go and buy that book and kind of read it and hope that some Gary Cole energy kind of seeps in, you know, sometime in September when I can actually afford to have some more energy in Japan right now.
Right. Yeah, that's right. And this is a process, you know. And one important thing to realize is that what we do not do on a day-to-day basis, we are going to be unable to do in a crisis situation. So if we want to be ready for that crisis situation when something violent is happening, we need to respond non-violently, we maybe will be unable to do that unless we do the individual deed of Christ-like love on a daily basis. Get up in the morning and say, instead of, boy, it's a jungle out there, how am I going to take care of number one, you know? Instead, have that mindset, how can I do the Christ-like deed on a day-to-day basis? And that may be the advantage. Question?
I suppose a question and a comment. You know, you had mentioned from the very beginning that the job really isn't getting done in our seminaries or our institutions of higher learning that, are supposed to help our pastors be able to pass the word on, and that this is more or less being put off onto the side. You know, I can't help but remember the great propaganda that took place in regards to the Iraq War, when George Bush used the media to go ahead and portray this man, and he did do some evil things. But, I mean, it was way overboard when you look back at what he did to try and make this a, quote, just war. The other aspect is in regards to the technology that is available today. Like we look back into Germany and Nazi Germany and the technology that they use as far as propaganda to disseminate a number of different viewpoints. But today, I mean, it's even quicker, it's even faster, and it's even more scarier when we look at other religious denominations who have their own broadcast programs that, you know, that appear daily as far as a brainwash. Any thoughts on that?
We are in a society that wants quick and stimulated information. We make our political decisions on headlines, 20-second sound bites also. We don't have the time in this, hell of a rat race to really spend the time in doing the reading. There's so many things competing. And the media, capitalist, conservative, basically. I mean, the media is always accused of being a liberal socialist media. It's the opposite, 80% of the major media are owned by corporations who are in it for profits with shareholders who demand that you sell papers. And violence and sex sells papers. And, sensationalism sells papers. So we are very easily brainwashed as an affluent capitalist society. The two women up there that just left are from Germany. They just arrived a couple days ago, and they were at the forum last night, and I met with them afterwards. They came up and thanked me for, being a voice for peace, but one of them was in tears. She just was so horrified at some of the things that went on, justifying war, and justifying violence, and justifying the Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And these kids are aware kids that looking at America from